From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, what drug addiction does to the brain and to your ability to experience pleasure. We talk with Dr. Nora Volkoff, director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse. Her neurobiological research has helped demonstrate that addiction is a disease of the brain, and that all addictions to drugs, alcohol, tobacco, gambling, and even food are more alike than previously thought. Also, the science behind extreme food delicacies, delicacies that most of us would find pretty revolting, like coffee brewed from a rare bean extracted from the feces of a cat-like animal. We talk with food scientist Massimo Marcone. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Why do some drugs make you feel so good until they leave you feeling so bad? Dr. Nora Volkoff wants to know what addictive drugs do to the brain. She's one of America's top researchers on the neurobiology of addiction. Her research has contributed to the idea that addiction is a disease of the brain. Volkoff is the director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse. One of the things she studies is how drugs affect the brain's chemical transmitters, like dopamine, which is associated, among other things, with motivation, drive, and pleasure. Volkoff grew up in Mexico in the house that the Russian revolutionary Leon Trotsky lived in after fleeing his country. She's Trotsky's great-granddaughter. Dr. Volkoff, welcome to Fresh Air. Why do drugs like heroin or cocaine create, at least initially create, a sense of pleasure? What's happening in the brain?
What happens is when someone takes the drug acutely, the dopamine will go up at very high concentrations. With repeated administration, your brain starts to adapt to it, undergoing a shifting on the threshold. As a result of that, you will need more and more and more dopamine in order to have the same perception. Your brain becomes tolerant to the effects. And these, in turn, will contribute to you wanting to take the drug, because without it, you no longer feel normal. In other words, it has changed from wanting to take the drug because you like the way it made you feel, you wanted to get high, to needing to take the drug because otherwise you do not feel normal.
Now, do different people have different amounts of dopamine in their brain? And does that explain at all why some people seem more prone to drug problems than others?
Yes, definitely. There are very different ways. I mean, there are many differences among people in the way that the dopamine system works. For example, one of the variables that we know is we contribute to the differences in activity of dopamine is your age. As you grow older, there is a decrease in the function of the dopamine system. And it is believed that, in part, this decrease in the function of the dopamine system is one of the reasons that may underlie why, as you grow older, you are much less sensitive to the pleasurable effects of drugs. It is also believed that your genes may determine, to a different or lesser extent, how sensitive your dopamine system is going to be. In other ways, how much are you going to be activated by natural reinforcers as well as aversive stimuli, which are dependent, those responses, on how sensitive the dopamine system is. So it is your age, it is your genes. We also know that repeated drug use decreases on the long term, decreases the activity of this dopamine system. So if you've been smoking for years, if you've been drinking for alcohol for years, that's likely to decrease the activity of the dopamine system. And finally, there is also evidence that there are environmental factors that may be modulating how sensitive your dopamine system is. For example, if you get an acute stress, that will activate the dopamine system. But if you are continuously exposed to stress, a chronic stress, that in turn produces the opposite. You become much less sensitive. Your dopamine system is not so reactive. So all of these factors contributed to the variability among all of us.
Now, what are some of the drugs that act in the way you're describing on the dopamine system?
All of the drugs that are abused by humans that have the potential to produce addiction, whether they are legal, alcohol, nicotine, or illegal, such as heroin, methamphetamine, amphetamine, marijuana, all of them increase dopamine. They do it by different mechanisms. Interestingly, though, there are some medications that can also do that. And as a result of that, because they can increase dopamine, they can also produce addiction. What are the three classes of medications that increase dopamine that have this problem? One of them, the most important, is pain medications that contain opioids. Opioids are the systems that are activated by drugs like heroin and morphine. So analgesics activate these systems, and through these, if they exert, they're very powerful analgesic effects. So that's one of them. The second class of drugs is the stimulant medications, and these are drugs like Ritalin or amphetamine that we use for the treatment of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD. We also use them for the treatment of narcolepsy. These drugs are called stimulants, and they share many pharmacological properties that are similar to both cocaine and methamphetamine. And thus, they can also, if used inappropriately, can produce addiction. And finally, we have the type of drugs that we would describe as sedative hypnotics, and this includes benzodiazepines and barbiturates. These are drugs that are frequently prescribed to help people that have problems with sleep better. They are also prescribed as muscle relaxants. They can also produce addiction.
Now, it's through your research that you learned that cocaine actually has a toxic effect on the brain. What is that toxic effect?
Cocaine is not just my research, actually, it's the research from many others. And cocaine can be toxic to the brain for more than one mechanism. I was initially interested because I was doing studies, brain imaging studies, the first of their kind, in cocaine abusers. And when I looked into their brains, it looked like they had small strokes. And this was at the beginning of the 80s, and at that time, people thought that cocaine was a pretty benign drug. So I was pretty shocked by the findings. Then it became clear that, indeed, cocaine can trigger cerebrovascular accidents. And what is that? That could be an hemorrhage or a stroke. And it does it because...
A hemorrhage or a stroke?
Yes. And what happens is cocaine increases for one's blood pressure, but it also can decrease the diameters of the blood vessels, what we call vasoconstriction. And if you vasoconstrict sufficiently, you can actually deprive a certain area of the brain of blood. Now, the brain is incredibly sensitive of lack of blood because it needs the oxygen to survive, and that in turn produces ischemia. And depending on where it happens, you can have, and how long it lasts, you can have just a transient sense of not being able to move your face properly, or you can actually become blind, or you can become paralyzed. So that was the first study that I did, in fact, regarding cocaine that related to its toxicity. Subsequent studies have also shown, and this is also work from my colleagues at Brookhaven National Laboratory, have shown that cocaine is also a local anesthetic. And by being a local anesthetic, it increases the concentration of an ion, calcium, inside the cells in the brain. And these can be very toxic to the cells, because if you accumulate it, eventually it can actually kill those cells. So these are two mechanisms by why it is believed cocaine can produce damage into the brain. And these are different from the changes that account for what we call addiction. So these are the effects of cocaine that can produce toxicity to the brain. And by the way, they can also produce toxicity to other organs.
So the descriptions of the stroke-like symptoms that cocaine can produce in the brain, are they reversible or is that permanent damage?
It depends, as I was saying, first of all, on the duration and the extent of the damage. If it's very temporary, then there's significant recovery and you can recover completely. But if it has produced long-lasting ischemia, then basically it becomes irreversible. You destroy the brain tissue.
Now, you've also concluded that addiction corrupts brain networks. What does that mean?
Well, what I would describe by that is the repeated use of drugs in those people that are vulnerable. It doesn't happen on everybody. Those that are vulnerable because they have the genetics, because they're staging their life where they are vulnerable. Those individuals, in those people, the repeated use of drugs leads to plastic changes in the brain that actually ultimately undermine the function of circuits in our brain that allows us, for example, exert self-control, that motivate and drives our behavior, and that are also very much implicated in process of memory and learning. So that's where the issue of the repeated use of drugs corrupts the brain in the sense that it changes the way it functions. It actually changes its biochemistry and function. And that in turn, of course, results in changes in behaviors.
My guest is Dr. Nora Volkoff, the director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse. She's also the great-granddaughter of Leon Trotsky and grew up in the house he'd moved to in Mexico after finding asylum there. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Nora Volkoff. She's director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse, which is part of the National Institute of Health. And she's done a lot of original research on the nature of addiction and what happens in the brain when somebody becomes addicted. So learning all the things that you've learned about the effects of the addictive drugs on the brain and how that affects other types of thinking, What has that led you to conclude about how we as a culture should deal with addiction, or the criminal model, the medical model?
I mean, in a way, I think that as a culture, we have not done very well on the way that we treat drug addiction. Even though we have been educating now for years, drug addiction is a disease of the brain, and as such, it should be treated medically. This concept has not been incorporated on medical practice. And this, for example, is reflected by the fact that most private medical insurances will not cover for the treatment of drug addiction. And if they cover, most of them cover for it inadequately. And this really stems from the belief that drug addiction is a lifestyle choice, which is pretty paradoxical. And I think about it and I sort of says, throughout all of these years as a clinician, I've never, and it's actually 26 years to be exact, never met a person that was addicted that wanted to be addicted. Addiction is not a choice. You choose, usually in adolescence, to experiment with drugs. But a lot of young people in our country do experiment with drugs, and only a few will become problematic users. And those outcomes actually are not choices, but they are biologically determined.
So, you know, a lot of people say, well, marijuana is a gateway drug. Do you see it differently? Do you think, like, for somebody who's prone to using drugs, who has that kind of, like, you know, the right kind of dopamine receptors and genetics and everything, that for them getting started on marijuana might lead to other drugs, but it's not something inherent about marijuana as a gateway drug?
Well, I would put it differently. I would basically bring forward that two are possible. And also, I would like to take one step behind and say, before marijuana, what studies have shown that appears preceding marijuana is nicotine. So actually, very early experimentation with cigarettes increases the likelihood that then you will experiment with marijuana and that then you will experiment with other drugs. So it's not just the concept of marijuana being the gateway drug, but the possibility that early exposure to certain drugs, and what are the drugs that young people are more likely to get access if you're a child, you're much more likely to get cigarettes than it is to get marijuana. We're trying to understand, actually, whether indeed in a person that may not have the genetic vulnerability, that because of an environment that's very permissive, they get access to cigarettes and they smoke. Would that in and of itself increase the risk of taking other drugs? Or is it that they had the genetic vulnerability that made them want to experiment very early on?
You mentioned that, that nicotine is the way a lot of people get introduced to drugs. How would you describe nicotine as an addictive drug? Look, in a scale of, you know, like nicotine, cocaine, meth, heroin, you know, where's nicotine?
I can use a chemical measure, if you want me to, which is all of these drugs increase dopamine, and the ability of drugs to increase dopamine is directly linked with their rewarding properties. So are there drugs that increase dopamine more? Yes. Which is the drug that increases dopamine the most? Methamphetamine. How does nicotine compare? Nicotine is probably, with alcohol, one of the drugs that increases dopamine the least. But you can smoke it. And as a smoking, you can also tritiate it. There's another aspect that's very different about nicotine. You can take this drug and continue with your life, meshing the drug taking with your work, meshing the drug taking with your pleasure, which is not happening with other drugs. I mean, you cannot just be snorting cocaine and working in a public environment, much harder to do. Nicotine allows you to actually marry the drug to your everyday activities. And this is dangerous because one of the things that we've come to understand, which, by the way, is absolutely fascinating that drugs do, is that when you increase dopamine, what you're doing to your brain is sending the signal that this is an experience that is very salient. It's not just pleasure, salient. And so you activate the memory systems that will remember it. They will remember the episode, who was there, but you will also remember the memory. And you will associate that memory and that emotion of the experience, not just with the drug, but with what surrounds you. And that's what we call conditioning. And the problem about conditioning with drugs is that when you become addicted, an object or a person that you've been conditioned to because you've taken the drug with will by itself increase dopamine in your brain, triggering the desire to take the drug.
You know, there's been a lot of scare campaigns directed at teenagers about all the things, like this is your brain on drugs, you know, about all the things, all the damaging effects that drugs can have on your brain. If you start taking them, do you think that that kind of scare campaign directed at teenagers is effective?
From studies that that have been undergone to try to determine what are the tactics that are most effective in decreasing the likelihood that kids will take drugs, what is evident is that one of the best prevention strategies you can do is to make the adolescent aware that other adolescents do not approve of this behavior. So if the adolescent feels that the others are taking it, they are much more likely to take that drug than if they feel that the others are not. So if you mount a prevention campaign through advertisements, to parent counseling, through school, that makes adolescents aware of that indeed other adolescents are not approving these drugs, you're much more likely to succeed. Now, coming specifically to the question to just sort of say, okay, you take your drugs and your brain is going to fry. I think that those scare tactics basically don't work because adolescents are very smart and they know many kids who are taking drugs and their brains have not fried. Unfortunately, they don't have the vision of what is going to happen to those adolescents when they go into junk adulthood. If they knew that, then they would be much more likely to not want to take drugs. So to me, the challenge is to be able to provide them with information that is salient to them, that is emotionally significant, so that then that can minimize the likelihood that they will take the drugs when other kids offer them to them.
I think one of the problems people face who are addicted to something, whether it's cigarettes or even food or something like meth or heroin, is that there are certain triggers to you wanting the drug. So certain things that you associate with taking the drug, and if you make that association, you want the drug. I mean, the most obvious thing is like you have a cup of coffee, you want a cigarette with it. You're working on ways that those kinds of associations can be broken in order to help people break the habit, whatever the habit is. Can you talk a little bit about what kind of research is going on in that area now?
Yeah, we are targeting two strategies. One of them, medications that can interfere with the increases in dopamine that occur when you get exposed to these conditioned responses, and thus that interfere with the craving. But we're also working with new strategies for helping individuals through biofeedback be better able to control those craving responses when they are experiencing them.
Sometimes addicts don't seek help because there's such a stigma to being an addict and they don't want to admit that they are. And also, they might be punished for admitting that they are if they're addicted to an illegal substance. Does that get in the way of the way you'd like to see addiction treated?
Of course, absolutely. And I think that's probably one of the main issues. 85% of individuals that are addicted and require treatment will not seek treatment. So even if we had the medications, and we have already treatments, we have treatments that work in drug addiction. And we cannot, the patients that are addicted to it cannot benefit because they are not accepting that they have a problem and are not seeking help. And this is driven by multiple factors. Of course, stigmatizing drug addiction is not helping. The notion that people react to patients that are addicted and become judgmental, they are ashamed. The patients are ashamed to bring it up. So they have to overcome that fear. And so if they are mistreated, the likelihood that they will come back is lower. They go to their doctors, and the doctors may feel uncomfortable actually asking about drugs, so they don't. And they want the patients who are ashamed of their drug-taking behavior are not going to bring it spontaneously. So we are missing a lot of unique opportunities where we could bring these patients and engage them and motivate them and refer them to proper treatment.
Dr. Nora Volkoff is the director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse. We'll talk more about addiction in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of In Pale Battalions by Robert Goddard, a suspense novel that explores the consequences of one family's secrets. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. And from Universal Pictures presenting Breach, inspired by the true story of the Robert Hansen spy scandal, starring Chris Cooper and Ryan Phillippe, now on DVD. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more with Dr. Nora Volkoff, the director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse. She's also the great-granddaughter of Leon Trotsky. Also, forget Starbucks. The real coffee delicacy is brewed from rare beans extracted from the feces of a wild animal. We talk with food scientist Massimo Marcone, who investigates bizarre delicacies around the world.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Dr. Nora Volkoff, the director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse. She's one of America's top researchers on the neurobiology of addiction. Now, we've been talking about drugs, but you're also studying obesity in people who overeat and become obese as a result. Do you consider food an addictive substance?
Food can produce compulsive behavior of taking, and it can produce devastating consequences to the person that cannot control it. So in that respect, it has similarities to what we call addiction. However, because there's not an official definition of what constitutes addiction to food and what does not, I tend to be cautious about it. But what I can say is that, yes, we have seen changes in the brain of pathologically obese patients that are similar to those that we have seen in people that are addicted to other drugs like cocaine and alcohol. But we have also seen clear-cut differences in obese patients that are not seen in patients that are addicted to drugs. So they share certain systems and circuits and chemicals, but there's also very significant differences. Food is probably so extraordinarily important for survival that biology has generated many systems to ensure that you eat. And the system that is shared between motivation for food and motivation for drug is that relates to the pleasurable, the rewarding effects of food. But of course, we eat also because we need nutrition, we need glucose.
So you can't stop eating. Like, you can stop heroin, but you can't stop eating.
And no, you cannot stop eating. You'll die, and which, yeah. Of course, makes it much harder. And one of the things, I did a study, I think close to 4 years ago, in which we were exposing just the normal weight people to food stimuli that they like in the scanner. So we were imaging the brain while they saw this food. And they couldn't eat it. They knew they couldn't eat it. But just seeing this food increased dopamine in those pleasure centers of the brain, just like happens with drugs. And that increased their desires to the food. So that made me think every time that I go and buy a book and I pay and they have all of these Godiva chocolates, I think my dopamine is going up in my brain and I have this desire to eat them. And so these are reflex responses, conditioned responses that makes it hard as a society where food is so widely available, it's so appealing, it tastes so good, and it's so cheap. That we can actually, it's no wonder that we have no more of a problem of overweight than what we already have.
I'd love to hear your opinion on the medical use of marijuana.
The medical use of marijuana. You know, marijuana activates the reward centers, pleasure centers, by stimulating proteins that are there for us to feel pleasure, to feel less pain, which we call the cannabinoid receptors. So the cannabinoid receptors are proteins that are incredibly abundant in our brain that subserve many functions. So it's not surprising that, for example, you can target and develop medications that that can activate these cannabinoid receptors, just like marijuana does. That could be potentially very good medications for pain. There has also been interest for these type of medications against nausea. So if you are in chemotherapy, there's also been interest about these medications to enhance your appetite. So if, for example, you have AIDS and you have no hunger, this is very helpful. There's also been interest about glaucoma. The problem with marijuana to treat these disorders is that when you are taking marijuana, you're not just taking that tetrahydrocannabinoid, which is the one that activates the receptors, but you're actually taking hundreds of chemical compounds. And you are generating not just the pharmacological desirable effects, but also undesirable effects, including, for example, sedation. And that's why, in my perspective, is if you can generate compounds that can do the pharmacological actions without the untoward effects, well, then use those. You don't need to use marijuana.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Nora Volkoff. She is the head of the National Institute on Drug Abuse, which is part of the National Institute of Health. Now, you come from a really interesting family, and it's quite a story. Your great-grandfather was Leon Trotsky, the Russian revolutionary who split from Lenin and was a leader of the Bolsheviks. He was exiled and wound up in Mexico in the mid-30s and was assassinated by one of Stalin's men in 1940. You grew up in Mexico, in part in the house where your great-grandfather lived. I believe one of your grandfathers was shot to death in a Stalinist prison. How aware were you of all of this history when you were growing up?
Well, I lived with it because I was born in the house that where Trotsky was killed. So even though my father had us living in a little house by the side of the house where he had been killed, during the day we will go and look at his books and play around with his clothes or the clothes of his wife. And over the weekends, we would show the house to visitors that came all over the world to see the house. So it was always very present. At the same time, what was interesting was that we were not allowed to ask my father about Trotsky when we were children because of the fear that this was such a painful memory for him. And indeed, my father did not speak about his heritage until I was, I think, 14 or 15 years of age. That's the first time he ever agreed to speak with a newspaper. He never wanted to speak about it. I think it was very traumatic for him as a child.
It was also the period of the Cold War.
More than that, I think in this case, it was just how hard. I think that probably my father was of those that follow, one of the ones that suffered the most as a child because his parents were taken away from him. He was left an orphan very, very young.
Taken away from by Stalin.
Yeah. I mean, he was taken away from his country, from his sister. His mother commits suicide. His father is sent to a concentration camp and disappears. His uncle, with whom he was living, also dies in Paris. And then they had to take him, Leon Trotsky, took care of him as a young boy. But it must be very traumatic as a child to see all of these people you love being killed.
So did he try to protect you from all of those fears?
Yes, I mean, my father didn't. I mean, I think that my father actively protected us from getting involved when we were young on political activities. I think he felt that the price the family had paid was just too great.
And how did you start doing drug research?
Well, I started doing drug research because I've always been interested in human behavior and the fascination about what motivates us to do things and what happens in people that are addicted when they no longer can control their acts. So that notion of understanding what happens in the brain of a person that even though they say, I don't want to do it, they cannot control it. And it fascinates me because it's at the essence of what we consider free will, the ability for self-control, the ability to exert voluntary control over your behaviors. And in people that are addicted, this is really badly undermined. So we wanted to understand why, so that we could treat it. I mean, I've always been interested on treating drug addiction as you treat other medical diseases. There's no reason why not. We just have not developed the knowledge or we don't have sufficient medications. But I believe, firmly believe, that we will. We need to invest on it. It's not going to happen spontaneously or automatically. But as we develop the knowledge and as we invest on development of these medications, we will be able to offer treatments, just like we offer now for epilepsy or we offer for depression.
Have you ever tried drugs out of just like curiosity since you study them so much? Or did you ever try them before you started studying them the way so many young people do?
You know, when I was, there are two things, basically. I lived in an incredibly protected environment when I grew up, and so I did not get the exposure to illicit substances. I think that the first time I was offered an illicit substance was when I was in medical school, never in high school. So as an adolescent, I was not ever even exposed to it. And by then in medical school, and I've always valued enormously my brain, and so I did not want to do anything that could jeopardize my ability to think or feel or experience. I'm very sensitive to that. However, when I was an adolescent, I was learning to speak French, and I would go to the class, and there was this teacher, very glamorous French woman, and she smoked. So I wanted to be like her, and I tried to smoke, and I hated the way it made me feel, and I tried again, and I became nauseated. So after 5 or 6 times, I just gave up. So I did try smoking. I must have been 15, 16 years of age. But fortunately, I had the genes that made me respond to it in an aversive way.
Just one more question. What is there a moment that you consider the most exciting moment in your career when you discovered something, say, through a brain scan about the effects of a drug on the brain?
You know, it's interesting because when I wouldn't say there's a particular one moment. It's almost that's why I would sort of say I'm so addicted to research, because the moment that you can comprehend something that someone else has not, where you see an association that clarifies something, is extraordinarily rewarding. It's almost, it's aesthetic, it's incredibly pleasurable. And every time that I face myself with understanding data that allows me to understand better a process, I would say I get very excited. So it's hard for me to say which one has been the particular moment that I was jumping up and down and said, oh my God, this is extraordinary. I look at the brain scan, I said, this is extraordinary. I look at the data, I said, my God. What this data is telling me, it's actually, I like data to surprise me. So I fortunately always get very excited when something new and unexpected arrives.
Well, Dr. Volkoff, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're very welcome.
Dr. Nora Volkoff is the director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse. Coming up, an interview not for the squeamish about revolting food delicacies. We hear from food scientist Massimo Marcone about his adventures researching these delicacies. This is Fresh Air. The so-called delicacies you're about to hear described are pretty revolting, but food scientist Dr. Massimo Marcone says the foods he studies are not fear factor foods like fried cockroaches or raw earthworm cocktails. He studies uncommon variations of perfectly respectable and mainstream foods, like salad dressing oil from nuts excreted by goats. Marcone has traveled the world researching bizarre delicacies. He teaches food science at the University of Guelph in Canada. His new book is called In Bad Taste, The Adventures and Science Behind Food Delicacies. Marcone spoke to Fresh Air's frequent guest host, Dave Davies.
Well, Massimo Marcone, welcome to Fresh Air. You begin your book by describing a very rare and expensive coffee, Kopi Luwak. What's distinctive about this product?
Kopi Luwak is one of those very interesting foods that have basically come from the back end of an animal. What happens is that there's a palm civet, which is an animal much like a raccoon, that eats the coffee cherries and then excretes them. And for the last 200 years, people have been collecting them, washing them, roasting them, and this is Kopi Luwak coffee.
Now, you said coffee cherries, and how is that? Is that different from coffee beans?
Yes, so what happens is you have two coffee beans within a cherry, so there's an outer parchment and flesh around the coffee seeds, and that is our coffee cherry, and it's very sweet, and that's what the animal is attracted to.
Okay. Just describe it for us. When you're looking at a pile of this animal excrement, do you actually see the coffee beans?
Yes, really, you don't see very much of the brown organic matter. Really, what we see is a bunch of coffee beans which are stuck together by this mucilage, which comes from the coffee cherry. So really, it doesn't look like regular feces as one would think of, you know, in the kitty litter box. It's just coffee beans stuck together. It looks, has a very much like a spider type of shape to it.
How does the passage of the coffee beans through the digestive tract of this little animal, the civet, affect the bean and affect the flavor?
Well, the bean is affected on the surface where we get a certain level of pitting, which ends up being a ballistics fingerprint of the bean going through the GI tract. But also the gastric juices are getting into the bean. They break down the proteins, and then through the roasting process, these proteins react to form different flavor components in the coffee itself.
So did you actually brew coffee from the beans collected from this animal's excrement?
I sure did. I was able to brew some of the coffee right in the rainforest. What we had is we had a generator with us, and I had brought equipment to be able to roast up the coffee. So we were able to roast it up. Depending upon how long it took the people to find the coffee. So if they were able to find it right after it had come out of the animal, it was of a much superior quality than those coffee scats that had remained in the rainforest for a few days. So we were able to grade them depending upon when they were collected. So that was a new piece of information we had.
Now, this coffee, I'm sure, grows on trees, and one could harvest the beans as others are done. Now, did you get some beans that had not been eaten and excreted by this little animal and compare the taste of that coffee?
Yes, that was very important. That's what we call a control, so the coffee that has not gone through the animal. And we were able to guarantee that we had the proper control in that it is known that the civet stays within a very small geographic location. And therefore, when we find the scat, we would know that that would be the geographic location of where it had consumed that coffee. So the control was easy to find. So I collected that, and we were able to make a comparison. Now, organoleptically or taste-wise, we could tell that the Cote Biluac had a more chocolate overtone. So the top note was that of chocolate, and then it had two sub notes of an earthy type and musty type flavor. So it's a very distinct compared to the control itself.
And how expensive is this Cote Biluac coffee?
Well, the Cote Biluac coffee is, in fact, about $600 a pound if one can find it. But again, it's not something that is very easy to find. Usually people can only buy it in a quarter pound lots, and you usually have to put your name in a queue, and there's usually about 300 people waiting to get a quarter pound. So you don't always get it the season that you put your name in for it.
And I guess there's an industry of people in these remote areas of Indonesia that gather this this excrement from the civet and collect the beans.
There is, and that's what sometimes leads to problems in that. What I've seen in my study is that 42% of the Cote Biluacs that are being presented on the market as Cote Biluac coffee are in fact adulterated, so they've had other coffees mixed in with them or are complete fakes. There's not a tight control which occurs with Cote Biluac coffee.
We're listening to Dave Davies speaking with food scientist Massimo Marcone, author of In Bad Taste. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to the interview that Fresh Air's frequent guest host Dave Davies recorded with Dr. Massimo Marcone, author of In Bad Taste. He's a food scientist who travels the world studying bizarre and kind of revolting delicacies.
You write about a very strong and unusual cheese from Italy whose distinguishing characteristic is the presence of maggots. Did you believe this story when you heard it?
Well, in fact, I was told about this story by my mother, who remembers my grandfather consuming this cheese shortly after the Second World War. And so my mother says that she had consumed the cheese herself and quite liked it. And so therefore, I went to Italy to determine if I could find out anything scientifically about this particular cheese and to find out where its origin was. Was it the origins from Sardinia, as people indicated, or was it more towards the center of Italy where my grandfather was from? And it really is a cheese that is like no other. It's a cheese with millions of little maggots in it. And it's eaten, cheese and all. So you're eating the maggots and the cheese. So it's a full package deal.
Tell us about your first encounter with this cheese, this casu frasico.
Well, this cheese is illegal to purchase, and therefore it's sold on the underground. And what happens is that unless you know people very well, they're not going to sell it to you because they know that, you know, they can get themselves into legal hot water if they do. So I had a journalist and a linguist go out and get the cheese for me. And I remember that when I walked into the apartment, the first thing that I was met by was this strange odor, strong odor of cheese, which was, you know, emanating from the kitchen. And as we got closer and closer, it's a cheese that first you can smell it and then you can hear it. And the reason I say you can hear it is that those little maggots, those millions of little maggots that I said are in the cheese, are literally jumping. And as they're jumping, they're hitting the container that the cheese is in. And you can hear this click, 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 click sound from the maggots themselves. So it's a very interesting. We usually don't think of hearing our food, but in this case, you can smell it, hear it, and see it.
All right, so bring us to the moment of truth. You had some of this cheese, maggots and all. What did it taste like?
Well, first of all, I didn't want to taste it because I thought, oh, no, I can't do this. This is too bizarre. So I finally got that. What they did, though, was they put it into the refrigerator for me to quiet down the maggots so they wouldn't jump me as I was trying to consume them, because they get all over you. They're on your clothes and your hair as you're trying to eat it. And it was had a very distinct flavor to it. It had a very strong, almost a niche-y type of taste and sensation in your mouth. And it was soft, like much like a camembert cheese. And to be totally honest, it was very pleasant to eat. It was something that, you know, without the maggots, it would have been a perfectly good cheese that you would just say it's great to eat.
And I have to ask, could you actually taste the maggots themselves individually? Because they're in your mouth, too.
They're all in your mouth, too. But really, you can't. You don't even have the texture of the maggots because they're really incorporated into the cheese themselves. And I should say that they're very small. They're almost microscopic in nature. They're not the big maggots that we think of that are associated with rotting things. Really, the maggot that we get is from a certain type of fly. It's not the house fly that is producing the maggots, but a certain type of fly which associates itself with the dairy-type environment. And the maggots are very small, almost microscopic. You can't see them.
What do the maggots do to the cheese?
Well, what happens is that the maggots themselves, cells, they burrow through the cheese, and therefore they change the texture of the cheese to a more softer type of cheese. And at the same time, they excrete certain types of secretions, which really cause a change in flavor in the cheese. You get a breakdown of the fats, and therefore you get that different flavor development due to the maggots being present themselves. And we were able to test cheeses that had not been infected with the maggots, and there was a very distinct flavor difference. There wasn't that same type of strong, itchy flavors I would describe it as, and hot flavor that I would describe of the ones with the maggots, nor was it that soft. So the maggots were integral to the production of this type of cheese.
Is this widely eaten in certain areas of Italy, and it's simply known that you don't sell it openly, but is consumed?
It's consumed in almost every region of Italy, whether people will tell you that they consume it or not. People know that people kind of frown upon it, so sometimes they'll even keep it silent with regards to that. This casu frasico is actually served as a centerpiece at certain weddings also. It's considered something of very high value, and so people want to have it as part of their festivities. So it's very common throughout Italy.
And the noise adds to the occasion, too, also, I suppose.
Well, of course, it's there.
Why is this cheese illegal in Italy?
that was a question that was brought forward. And really what I believe, and I stand to be corrected or not, but I submit that really, because Italy has a big cheese market and exports all over the world, they really fear that if people know that they're into this type of cheese, that they're consuming this, that it will be reflect badly upon the cheese industry as a whole. And therefore, they've put a ban in by saying, yes, we know that people consume it, but it's illegal to purchase it. And therefore, you know, we know what good cheese is and what bad cheese is.
In your book, you describe tracking down these seemingly bizarre foods that did come, as you said, from the rear ends of animals or accompanied by maggots, and discovered that, in fact, they really exist. Is there another legendary food that you're ready to pursue? What's next for you?
Well, there's something that I'm going to be doing in the fall is I'm going to be going to China. And I thought, well, Kopi Luwak was, you know, an anomaly. And then I find out that for the tea drinkers out there, there is a tea which is produced by, and it's consumed by an insect and excreted by an insect. And they produce one of the best teas in the world. And so therefore, I'll be going off to China in the fall and be on that pursuit. But I'm always pursuing other foods. And one could say to me, well, why does a scientist do that? Why does a scientist in a very prestigious university, we're considered the best food science department in all of Canada, why do I go and do this type of research? And really, the reason why I do is partly to make up for the prejudice that I had against foods. I really thought that I knew it all about these foods, and I knew what foods one could eat and what was good for you and what was bad for you. And some of these fear factor foods that I'm looking at, I had all my ideas why people should not be consuming them because they could cause harm and so on and so forth. And what I found out was that in many cases, these foods are as harmless as other foods that we are presently consuming. And therefore, I continue to go out. I continue to do the science behind these foods and bring them to people's attention. And so that, you know, we can have a broader experience together of what these foods are and what the science is behind them.
Well, Massimo Marconi, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Absolutely my pleasure.
Massimo Marconi is the author of In Bad Taste. He spoke with Fresh Air's frequent guest host, Dave Davies. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Minhivar. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Classics edition of The Federalist, papers by Hamilton, Madison, and Jay. In stores and online at bn.com. From the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, working to ensure that more students graduate from high school ready for college, work, and citizenship. GatesFoundation.org. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
He's the preeminent figure in the illegal weapons trade. He's armed Islamic extremists. And get this, Americans contracted his planes to fly supplies into Iraq. On the next Fresh Air, we talk about Victor Boot with journalist Douglas Farah and Stephen Braun, authors of Merchant of Death. Join us for the next Fresh Air.